First case is Uniloc v. Google, 2021-1498, Mr. Lampkin. So you're arguing Google,
The Google case, yes, thank you. Google. Good morning, may it please the court. I'd like to begin with the reason why the Google case, is distinct, and that any Fortress licensing right cannot defeat Uniloc standing. And the reason is this. Before this suit was filed, the parties entered into a termination agreement to expressly terminate any Fortress licensing rights, any Fortress rights regarding the patents here, for $26 million. As payment in full for all obligations, Fortress agreed that both prior agreements shall terminate and that the rights of each of the APCO parties under them shall terminate. And then for extra clarity, it went on and said there's a mutual release of all claims, and the definition of claims says that includes all rights, contracts, promises of every kind and nature whatsoever. That's certainly capacious enough to cover a right to license the patented issue. In terminating those agreements, and
even
all the rights...
Even though the license said that right was irrevocable?
Yes, Your Honor. As the district court said on page 17 of its opinion, of the appendix, this hinges on the meaning of irrevocable. But under New York law and common understanding, irrevocable does not mean that it's incapable of termination by mutual agreement of the parties. It means that one party can't unilaterally take it back. For example, if I hand in my license to DMV, the DMV hasn't revoked it. I've surrendered it. If I tell my daughter she can see a movie and she decides that she's not going to go, she hasn't revoked my permission to go see a movie. She's just declined to see it. A legion of cases makes that clear on pages 40 to 42 of our brief. It just walks right through it. Time and again, they say, yes, it says irrevocable, but that doesn't mean that it can't be.
Am I correct? This particular issue doesn't have the potential issue preclusion problems in the other two cases?
That's exactly correct. This agreement didn't exist at the time the Apple case was filed, and so the district court didn't address it. It just doesn't come up. And since we don't have a ruling on this issue, it can't be preclusive.
So if we agree with you on this issue and your view of this issue, we don't have to get to the broader issue of whether the Fortress license did something to your standing with regard overall, your bigger argument in the other cases.
That's correct. That would be just something that the court would have to reach in the other cases. But in this case, it just can't affect the outcome because irrevocable does not mean that it's incapable of termination by mutual agreement.
Well, they don't seem to be arguing that anyway. They appear to agree at page 34 of the red brief that it could be revoked if you use the right language, right?
Right. I think that they're saying that it naturally, on their brief, they say that it's something that sort of right that naturally survives the termination agreement. But if a license that's irrevocable is the sort of thing that the parties can mutually agree to terminate, it is not the sort of thing that naturally survives a mutual agreement to terminate. And so I don't think that argument works at all. Once the agreement is terminated, once all rights under the agreement are terminated, one of those rights, the right to license, is necessarily terminated as well.
And your suit occurred after that.
Pardon?
Your suit occurred after that.
That's exactly right. And it wouldn't make any sense for that licensing right to continue after the agreement is fully paid in full and after they've terminated the agreement, because this was a security for repayment of the loan.
Well, I guess there could be circumstances in which you would think that the license survived. For example, if they'd started manufacturing a product under that license and relied on the continued existence of the license. I mean, that's not the situation here, but it doesn't seem to me that it's apparent that in all circumstances the license would terminate.
So certainly the contract, the termination agreement, addressed one circumstance that would be similar to that, and that is if you had already issued sublicenses, those sublicenses would survive termination, so those third parties wouldn't be prejudiced. But there's nothing like that, and given the nature of the party...
There's nothing in the record here to show
that
they'd availed themselves, they've done anything
to
utilize the license.
This was actually a Fortress denied it even had a right to sublicense at this time. It was a right that was disputed and never exercised. And so there's just nothing in this record that would suggest that the parties would think that this is some sort of right that would survive the termination agreement, especially since it's a security agreement. Once the loan's paid off in full, there's no reason for that never exercised security right to continue. It would be a bit like saying, you know, I've paid off my mortgage, the bank has agreed that I've paid off my mortgage, but the bank still has a lien on my house, can still foreclose, or can rent out my bedroom in order to ensure it gets paid. It doesn't make sense there, and it makes no sense here either.
If we don't agree with you, what about the Weav case, if I've pronounced it properly? Isn't that a real problem for you?
In terms of whether we have standing?
Yes.
Yes, and I think the problem with cases like Weav and the like is they conflate exclusive licensee standing with patent owner standing. And patent owners are distinct in that whenever you are the owner of a patent, if you have not surrendered all substantial rights so as to make somebody else the patent owner, you have standing. As the court said in Pandrel, establishing ownership of a patent that has been infringed satisfies the requirements of Article 3 standing, or aspects. Because we conclude that the contour was the owner of the 747 patent when the original complaint was filed, and thus had standing to sue in this action, we vacate the district court's dismissal. Section 154 is very clear that it gives the right to exclude to the patent owner. The fact that the patent owner will license other people at times doesn't mean that it loses that statutory right of exclusion. That's true under...
I would agree with you that the court seemed to be off the track when it was talking about what constitutes an exclusive license. The discussion of right height was way off because right height dealt with distributors.
Exactly.
But the court also said that the ownership... In this case, that if we have found that an exclusive licensee with the right to sue no longer had standing because a putative defendant could obtain a license, then the court held that we have applied here. Is that right?
So if I remember we have correctly, and in that case, the concern was whether somebody was an exclusive licensee. And when somebody else has the right to license the infringer, you're not an exclusive licensee. But it doesn't mean that if you're the owner of the patent, and there are people with the right to license, you, as the owner of the patent, lose your right to exclude. Because not only does the statute, Section 154 itself, give you that right, it says, as a patentee, you have the right to exclude. But common experience tells you that, too. You know, my daughter may be able to invite whoever she wants to our house, but that doesn't mean I lose standing when someone who no one invited invades the premises. My wife and I might have a joint bank account and our accountant can draw from it and we can give other people to draw from it. That doesn't mean that the fact that there's multiple people out there who can utilize this, that we lose standing to object when someone embezzles all of our money. Patent law is the same way. If you're the owner of the patent, 154 gives you the fundamental patent right, which is the right to exclude. That doesn't go away with other people having licenses. It's also clear that when you are, and the reason we have this sort
suppose of... the patent owner is granting an exclusive license to someone else and says, I surrender the right to license the patent myself.
Yeah. So it's not altogether, they lose the right to license themselves. But it doesn't mean necessarily they lack the right to exclude, because that comes from the statute itself. And you don't lose that unless you cease to be the patent holder, unless you've transferred all substantial rights. Now, the reason we look at licensees so carefully is because the Supreme Court in Independent Wireless in 1926 kind of went well beyond the statute. The statute says the right to exclude is with your patentee. It's with your owner. That's the heartland of the right to exclude. An Independent Wireless...
Surely if the patent owner transferred the right to license and the right to sue for infringement, it would no longer have rights that gave it standing, right?
No, I don't think that's necessarily true, because you would have to look, and this court's very careful and very contextual in looking at those things. You'd have to conclude that the patent owner has given away all substantial rights.
How can it be if they've given away the right to sue for infringement that they have standing?
Well, they certainly have an injury in fact, and they have the right to exclude under the statute. They may, as a matter of a cause of action, have surrendered their ability to assert a cause of action. There might be a contractual defense that you don't have, you're not the right person to sue. But I don't think, unless you actually look at it and say, they have surrendered all substantial right, they've ceased to be the patentee, then they still have standing to sue. And I think Case and Case recognizes that once at Alfred Mann, for example, either the patent licensor did not transfer all substantial rights to the exclusive licensee, in which case the licensor remains the owner of the patent and retains the right to sue for infringement, or the licensor did transfer all substantial rights to the exclusive licensee, in which case the licensee becomes the owner of the patent for standing purposes and gains the right to sue on its own. It's one or the other. There's always an owner of the patent. If you've surrendered ownership by surrendering all substantial rights, then that other person, your licensee, has become effectively the patentee and they can sue in their own name. If you've retained ownership, if you have not surrendered all substantial rights, you still have the right to sue. And the very fact that we...
My hypothetical, they've given up the right to sue. You're trying to argue too much.
Okay. Even if that were a case, if you gave that much, you might come to the conclusion that, look, you have at that point surrendered all substantial rights. You don't have the right to exclude others because you've given that up. You don't have the right to sue. You don't have the right... At some point, you cross that line. But this court's cases all point that line. And there's no argument here that Unilock somehow crossed the line and gave up all substantial right to the patents. I see that I'm into what would be my rebuttal time. If I can reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Mr. Bagatelle.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Dan Bagatelle on behalf of Google. With me are my colleagues Andrew Dufresne and Soap and Shaw. Whether a patent owner automatically has an Article III right to sue is an interesting legal question, but the Court need not and should not reach it in this case or in the other two cases because of two reasons. First, Unilock is collaterally stopped from contesting whether it had Article III standing as of 2017. And second of all, the 2018 payoff agreement made no difference in those circumstances. The Court shouldn't be bashful about that. This is not an issue that arises.
I have trouble with your theory that the agreement didn't eliminate the license. The language is pretty broad. You seem to agree that the fact that it's called irrevocable in the original agreement is not determinative.
Well,
when I read these provisions of the termination agreement, it says they've given up all rights under the agreement, and this would appear to apply to a license as well.
That's not quite right. What we agreed on was that the word irrevocable does not mean that Unilock and Fortress could bilaterally agree to terminate the rights. In fact, the dismissal here is with prejudice. Fortress and Unilock could solve this problem today. This is a dismissal without prejudice. But getting to the termination agreement, the difficulty for Unilock is that there's nothing in that agreement that says we're terminating Fortress's license. It does have a termination provision, but it's subject to an exception in 2BY, which basically says the release does not apply to things that survive based on what was in the original 2014 agreements. One of which, in Section 6, provided all rights that, by their nature, survive and continue. And that is what we are hanging our hat on. And that is where the comment...
If you look at page 913 of the appendix, in D1, it says the right of each of the applicable parties under the applicable agreement shall terminate. Pretty broad language, isn't it?
Yes, but I think you need to look at 915, Your Honor. Take a look where they're talking about, basically... All the rights that are being given up in 2BY contain an exception for any provision of any released agreement that survives the termination of such released agreement in accordance with its terms. So then we turn back to the original patent license agreement, Section 6, which is on page 614. It says, survival. Any rights and obligations which by their nature survive and continue after expiration of term or termination of this agreement will survive and continue and bind the parties and their successors and signs until such rights are extinguished. And that is what we did not have here. This is a right that was a paid-up, perpetual license. I mean, it was an irrevocable license.
Why is that a right that by its nature survives? The agreement specifically provides that sublicenses survive. Why does the license by its nature survive?
Well, they needed a special provision for sublicensees. I think actually that's been addressed in an opinion I believe Your Honor may have written it, where they need, it's an ambiguous otherwise, and so they put that in there specifically to make clear that sublicensees' rights survive. The rights of Fortress are governed by 6.0. It's not a specific versus the general issue. The specific is specific to the rights of sublicensees, of which we are not one. But the rights of Fortress survive based on Section 6. And the question is, what is by nature survive and continue?
Why is that? Why does the license by its nature survive and continue?
Because the license was fully vested and irrevocable by Unilock and perpetual.
Irrevocable by Unilock, but why not able to be terminated by joint agreement of the parties in exchange for consideration?
I agree that it could be, but I submit that it was not, because there's nothing in that agreement that says Unilock's license is terminated. And there isn't, it says rights are, the agreement is terminated, and certainly they paid off the principal that they were owed. That does not answer the question of whether Fortress's rights vis-a-vis the rest of the world, not Unilock, whether they have a license that they can still exercise, including the right to sublicense. It is.
But Fortress never sublicensed.
As far as we know, it did not.
They never exercised this right. So what vested?
Oh,
they had a pending right to sublicense, but they never used it.
No, well, it was usable as of the date of the default, which actually was the date of the agreement, because they were actually in default from the get-go, because they falsely represented and warranted that there had been no challenges to the patents. In fact, there had been challenges, and some of them were eventually held invalid or unpatentable. So that's, but basically, getting back to the issue, the question is, why does it by its nature survive? Because it was granted, and the license survives. It's not an absolute thing where you just simply terminate it because the agreement is terminated. Unilock gave Fortress the right to use the license, upon the event of a default. It's indisputable that there were numerous events of default, both in 2014 and 2017. That right vested. It was irrevocable by Unilock itself, and so there had to be something that specifically terminated it, and nothing terminated it. Actually, that's not quite true. They could also terminate it by provisions 7.3, X, Y, and Z. There were three ways to annul a default. None of those happened. There was no waiver. There was no express amendment that expressly cured the defaults, and the defaults didn't go away. They didn't. Unilock didn't cure them in any way. The financial defaults, not receiving the necessary revenue, didn't go away. That was never solved. And certainly the existence of challenges and the invalidity of the patent didn't go away. The challenges continued and patents died. So they remained in default. Those defaults were not cured. There were three ways to solve the problem, and they could even have solved it a fourth way in the termination agreement, the payoff agreement. But they did not.
So it really just comes down to how broadly we read the termination agreement.
Yes, in part, yes. I would say that the question is, what is by its nature survive? There is some case law that deals with perpetual rights, and I would submit there's no distinction here between a perpetual right and...
Make sure, if we agree with your friend's argument about this termination agreement and that it got rid of the Fortress license, then does Google have, or does Unilock have standing to sue Google?
Yes. Okay. We have to win two issues. I think the first set is dealt with by the collateral estoppel problem, but if you don't, then you reach the automatic Article III standing issue, which I would love to reach if your honors are interested, but we also need to win the payoff and termination agreement issue, because that occurred before we were sued in the latter part of 2018. Would your honors like me to address the collateral estoppel issue or anything else? Okay, I don't want to get out of turn. Turning to the collateral estoppel issue, there's no dispute over the basic elements of collateral estoppel. I mean, basically, it's the same issue. It's actually litigated. It's necessary to the judgment, full and fair opportunity to litigate.
Yeah, but Wright and Miller in some of the cases suggest that where it's a non-mutual collateral estoppel situation, there's some room for not applying it. I mean, I grant you that the discussion of Wright and Miller is a little bit opaque.
It certainly is, and the restatement also lists certain circumstances where non-mutual collateral estoppel may not be appropriate. For example, I think your cases have addressed it, circumstances where there may not have been a full and fair opportunity to litigate. It may have been very low stakes, you know, a $300,000 issue, and now you're dealing with a $100 million issue. There are all sorts of reasons that might apply. None of them apply in this case. What have they raised? They've raised basically no judicial economy. Well, obviously there'd be judicial economy. You'd certainly get rid of the Motorola and Blackboard cases and half of this case. And they also raised the fact that there has been a settlement. But U.S. Bancorp, the Supreme Court rejected the notion that simply settling is a reason to get rid of preclusive effects.
What if after they'd settled, they'd ask for a remand and for the district court to vacate the Apple decision and the district court had denied it? Would that have been a basis for us not to apply issue preclusion because it had been settled and they hadn't been given an opportunity to appeal that decision or at least get it vacated?
Well, what they should have done is made it conditional on district court approval. They did not do that. They didn't even ask Judge Alsup to do it. They didn't ask this court to remand to Judge Alsup, and they simply chose not to do it. And the idea that they were unaware of collateral estoppel is simply untenable. My learned colleague on the other side, we've known each other for 35 years, they spot issues very well. They raised five issues in their appeal brief that were not raised by district court counsel. The idea that they were unaware of collateral estoppel is pretty far-fetched.
Well, what difference would it make if they were unaware of collateral estoppel?
Well, I don't think it does.
We assume that people are aware of what the law is.
Yeah, but it's not an unfair situation, and let me get back to that. It's fundamentally not unfair. What we have here is a dismissal without prejudice. It was solvable by Unilock and Fortress at any time, and they simply elected not to do it. I don't know why. They could be back in court tomorrow.
But you know why? Because they'd be giving up a lot of the damages.
I don't know why they didn't do it in 2017 or 2018, Your Honor, and when it would have been a much smaller issue. But, you know, honestly, I'm not the one to answer that question. But the point is, this is not like we are saying the patent is forever unenforceable. It's not unenforceable. They simply don't have standing to enforce it. If you would like, I can turn to the automatic Article III standing issue, or I can continue on collateral estoppel if you prefer.
Your case.
Okay. Well, let me address the automatic Article III standing issue. And our position is that patent owners have Article III standing as long as they have exclusionary rights, but not when they don't. You start out with exclusionary rights, but you can contract them away. And that happened in the Morrow case when the right to sue and ownership were split, and that's what happened here. It's not some sort of talisman or magic potion.
Where is the right to sue and ownership split here?
No. What I'm saying is that you can have a situation where you've lost exclusionary
rights.
That's
the issue I find troublesome here is that there's no indication that Unilock ever transferred either the right to sue or an exclusive right to license. They maintained the right to sue. They maintained a right to license to other people. They just gave a license to Fortress as well, the sublicense.
A license with the free right to sublicense, unfettered, which meant that Unilock could not choose whom to exclude. Fortress could exclude anyone whom Fortress wanted.
But Fortress didn't.
They did not. But that's not the issue. I think actually if you take a look at the Luminara case, I think that's probably the clearest example. This was a case in which the patent owner was Candela/Luminara, and the defendant was Leone, and there was an issue about whether Disney was entitled to license other people as affiliates.
Look, let's look at this guy. Unilock did not in an agreement agree not to enforce its right to sue. And there was no license that was such an exclusive license that's tantamount to an assignment.
Yes.
So they didn't deprive themselves of the right to sue.
What they did do, however, and I'm not arguing Section 282 standing, Your Honor, or statutory right to sue. The question is Article 3 standing. Mr. Lampkin repeatedly mentioned Section 154. That is the exclusionary right. That is the sine qua non of the right to sue for infringement of patent rights. If you don't have exclusionary rights, you can't sue, even if you are nominally the patent owner. There's no reason to say simply that you have the nominal status as a patent owner. That changes everything. This court has said repeatedly, we don't just look at the labels.
Well, they didn't deprive themselves of exclusionary rights.
They gave away the right to exclude to Unilock by contract and then by defaulting.
They gave away the right to sue someone whom Fortress had licensed, and Fortress hadn't licensed anyone.
But they gave away the right to decide who could be sued. They let somebody else stand in and say, I can excuse you. Fortress, we could have gone to Fortress and gotten a license, and there's nothing Unilock could do about it. And that is what this court has looked at, to see whether you have the right to exclude the particular defendants. I'm not sure what the correct pronunciation.
Yeah, you're just using a phrase which has to be read in context. They have the right to exclude these people, assuming that somebody else doesn't take an action. So they have, it seems to me, the right, they have, and you don't dispute that they have the right to sue for infringement.
I would say if it's not a question of statutory ownership, it is a question of the Article III standing, which turns on their right to exclude this particular defendant.
Can we just back up?
Yes.
I mean, if you look in terms of basic Article III standing, they have a legally protected interest, right?
I think that's the question, Your Honor. The legally protected interest is the exclusionary right.
Ownership of the patent.
No, what the patent gives you is the right to exclude. The patent doesn't give you anything else. You always have the right.
Where did they give up the right to exclude? They gave up the right for another company to sub-license. But they could still sue everybody else that either they hadn't licensed or that company hadn't sub-licensed.
I think the answer is if another company, in this case Fortress, can come in and forgive a defendant.
That just doesn't seem, I understand your argument, but that just doesn't seem right to me. Because Fortress may choose not to sub-license anybody.
Well,
in which case, the only people that Unilock can't sue are Fortress. They can sue everybody else because Fortress hasn't sublicensed anybody.
Well, I guess my position...
Why isn't the better way of looking at... Sorry, I know I keep pausing and then going on. Why isn't that the better way of looking at Article III standing? Now, it could be true that if you get sued and you know Fortress can license you, you can go get a license, even a retroactive one, and then you can assert that and say, well, they don't have a cause of action here because we have a license. But why does that go to legally protected interest?
Because the legally protected interest under Section 154 and the Supreme Court's cases and this Court's cases is the right to exclude. And our position is that when you don't have the right to stop somebody, when somebody else can forgive infringement at their will.
I mean, you're assuming, this is circular, because you're assuming that they don't have the right to exclude when they give a potential license with a potential sub-license to somebody else. Where have we ever said that?
Well, the court certainly said that in the context of exclusive licensees. I will acknowledge there is not a square holding in either way about what is the situation with patent owners because it happens so rarely.
Okay, but the result of your argument is that nobody can sue for infringement.
Well, it's fixable. It's a dismissal without prejudice. They can be fixed.
No. But under with the legal structure the way it is, your theory is no one can sue for infringement.
At that moment, and the same was true in Morrow. Is exactly what this court held. That's
why there's no holding along those lines.
Because well, there was a holding in Morrow, actually.
That's an absurd result.
No, actually, I think in Morrow there was a holding that they couldn't proceed because in that case the right to sue and the ownership were separated.
You have a final thought?
No, Your Honor, I'll submit. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lampton, why is there no estoppel against in this case?
Excuse me.
Please do not dismantle the courtroom.
I apologize.
Should see me at home. So the answer is forfeiture. It wasn't the basis of the decision below. It wasn't raised below. Google notified the district court of the decision in Apple 3 days after it issued. It was issued on a Friday. Google notified on Monday. Said that there were similar issues involving the same.
This Third Circuit case, which seems to be the only case that deals with this question, says that you can move to sue until the judgment becomes final, right?
The Third Circuit, if you're talking about five unlabeled boxes, yes. So, of course, Google has invoked that case. This case comes out of the Ninth Circuit, not the Third Circuit. And
that's the problem with our law, looking to regional circuit law.
That's correct. But even
because the same judgment have different effect in different circuits, that can't be.
But. And I think that they don't cite any decisions from this circuit either. And the reason is that five unlabeled boxes doesn't get rid of the rule that you can't, that you forfeit your collateral estoppel argument if you don't raise it at the most prompt, reasonable opportunity. It doesn't say that you, it doesn't get rid of the exceptional circumstances you must show. It's just best understood as a case in which there were exceptional circumstances for the failure to raise it more promptly. So in that case, for example, we were dealing with mutual, not non-mutual estoppels. You had one party that would have been...
But you have no case the other way that suggests that by waiting until the judgment becomes final, you somehow surrender the issue, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. So the Seneca-Cuyuga case from the Tenth Circuit made it very clear that if you sit on your hands until after judgment, that's too late. And it's clear that that should be the case because the whole point of collateral estoppel, of issue preclusion, is to save everybody time and energy. But because they didn't raise this before the district court went off and addressed the merits. Because they didn't raise this before the district court, they're now asking this court to address collateral estoppel in the first instance where no court has before. Because they didn't raise collateral estoppel in the district court, we filed an opening brief addressing only the issues the district court had ruled on. We ended up having to address this for the first time on reply. All those things point against judicial economy. And it would be especially unfair to do that here because, for one thing...
Why doesn't it make more sense to wait until it becomes final to assert issue preclusion? I mean, when it's not final, why would other district courts defer to a non-final ruling? It might get reversed on appeal. They might disagree with it. A whole host of reasons why you wouldn't assert it until it became final.
So the general rule, and this case's decision of Pharmacia actually applies that rule, is that a decision is preclusive even if it's pending on direct review. And in Pharmacia, this court applied issue preclusion to a case even though that other case was still pending on direct review, and said, look, you know, if we reverse, then you can go back and ask for reopening. But we're not going to slow things down here, waiting for that to happen. And there's no exception to that rule, simply saying, well, there's a pending appeal, you can always get around it. There's an exceptional circumstances rule, like in five unmarked boxes, where you had mutual collateral stop.
What's your Tenth Circuit case? Where do you discuss
Cuyuga
that?
Seneca Tribe.
Where do you discuss that?
I'd have to look at the brief. I can give you it's 327 F3rd 1030, and it says, permitting related assertion collateral estoppel would do nothing to vindicate the two primary policies behind the doctrine, conserving judicial resources and protecting the parties from the expense and vexation of relitigation of issues another party previously litigated. That's precisely the case here. We not only have...
What I'm trying to get at, is that a case in which they waited until the judgment became final and were held to be precluded as a result of that?
Yes, they didn't raise it in the district court, and then the judgment became final, and they raised it for the first time on appeal.
No.
Oh, I see. The question is that a case in which the judgment was still pending on appeal and they hadn't raised it? No, that is not a case like that. But I think the standard rule is you got to raise it in the first practical opportunity.
There's no case which says that waiting until the judgment becomes final is fatal to your argument.
I don't think I have a case that says that, but I do think the principle that the case is preclusive means that you should be raising the first practical appeal. And the judge below in this case very much might have wanted to know if this was preclusive. She actually cited the Alsop opinion approvingly for various reasons on page 15, and we could have avoided all the discussion of the merits, which we've occupied a lot of time with already, if this had simply been raised below, which it was not. I see I'm through my time in 30 seconds as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Case is submitted.